The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. The first time in a quarter of a century, the Tories hold a by-election in government coming through against the UKIP insurgency in Newark. We'll be asking whether the Farage bandwagon has stopped so soon after it started, whether the Tory win is really as good as it seems, and where on earth this leaves the other parties, third place Labour and especially the Lib Dems who've collapsed where they might once have cleaned up. Also this week, we'll glance back at a crowning yawn of a Queen's speech and ask whether, in an administration that hasn't got much real work left to do, things are getting fractious. Witness the extraordinary spat between Theresa May and Michael Gove. Joining me to discuss all of this, we have our political correspondent, Rowena Mason, Hugh Muir, who's The Guardian's political diarist, and from The Observer, Toby Helm. A warm welcome to you all. Rowena, first of all, could you just fill any of our listeners in who've missed it on what happened overnight in Newark?
Yes, well, it was all pretty much as the polls had predicted. Conservatives came a very comfortable first, way ahead of UKIP, who did slightly less well than expected, about 15 or 16 points behind. And then Labour were trailing into third place, and the Lib Dems unfortunately lost their deposit for them.
I think I read last night the ninth deposit they've lost this season. So an unambiguous message, it would seem, Toby Helm, for the Liberal Democrats. As far as Labour and the Conservatives go, does this tell us anything much about what happens next time?
Yes and no, to give a irritating answer. It certainly tells us that the Tories can hold a seat where they are strong mid-Parliament. That's encouraging for them. It tells us that Labour is not the Labour that it was, you know, in the early days of Tony Blair. It's not sweeping up the popular vote. It's not sweeping up any of the protest vote. And it shows us that we have a new kid on the block, which is UKIP, which is taking a lot of votes from both parties and completely confusing the scene. But I would see this as a kind of local skirmish in a national civil war, which just shows you this is just one example, one set of conditions that won't replicate. You can't replicate across the entire country. You can replicate in certain areas of the country. And what you're going to see in this election, I think, more than this general election now is individual parties targeting seats very heavily. In Newark, you saw the Tories really, really target this seat very heavily. Parties with limited resources, key target seats. David Cameron went to the seat four times. Labour had written it off from the very beginning. UKIP didn't fight it very hard. All four parties are going to have their target seats, fight them very hard in the general election, and that's where the battle will be.
Hugh, do you think if you were David Cameron, would you be delighted that you've won a by-election, or would you be worried that we're now within a year of a general election and you've dropped down 9 points, more or less exactly as you did in those local elections that weren't so good a week ago?
I don't think you'd be delighted, but I don't think anyone will be massively unhappy, apart from the Lib Dems, of course, because, you know, he has held the seat. They have won this seat. And as you say, historically, parties in government don't win the by-elections in this way. And irrespective of the figures, UKIP begin to not look invincible. You know, they had a good, their vote was healthy enough. But you then, what really worries you if you get to the point where they just look as if they're kind of sweeping all before them. They probably knew that they wouldn't hear. In a way, Nigel Farage played it quite cannily, and he didn't stand in the seat. He sent Roger Helmer instead, who
looks like a good idea.
As a candidate, he had a lot of issues, let's put it that way. Farage, you know, when everyone else was doing the last minute canvassing, was to be found in Malta, being pictured on the front page of one of the tabloids with a young lady, all of which he explains is terribly innocent, but you know, he wasn't there. And so he can say, well, yes, we got a healthy vote, and with the implication that it would all have been better if I had paid a bit more attention to it. So, you know, he won't be too unhappy with it either. The Tories won't be too unhappy with it. And Labour, well, they can always say, well, this wasn't a seat we expected to do fantastically well in, and we didn't do fantastically badly.
Rowena, you've spent time there, haven't you? I mean, how did it feel on the ground? Did it feel like there was a real energy that Grant Shapps was
bringing together a young army of committed people who were really excited about the idea of another Tory win?
I think it had a lot of quite worried Westminster politicians up there, actually. I don't think the Tories would have thrown quite so much of their resources at it if they hadn't been a little bit rattled by what UKIP did in the European elections, coming first and topping the polls there. And it was a very bizarre atmosphere, really. You could wander around the market square in the town, and it was like Westminster Village. You'd bump into about three or four politicians who you recognise just walking down the street. I think it probably got a little bit annoying for the locals. There was one enterprising storeholder that was selling eggs to throw at the nearest politician you saw. There was a sort of an atmosphere of enthusiasm from something that Grant Shapps organised called the Road Trip 2015, where they basically bussed in activists from all over the country to help with the effort. But the question really is whether they could. I mean, they can't afford to do that in the general election across all the marginal seats in the country. There won't be that sort of ground army to help shore up seats like that in other places. So it might. It's difficult to know what you can read into this one. This one battleground scene.
I'm interested, though, in this tactic they had of bussing in all these young, bright, enthusiastic canvassers, on the doorstep and on the pull at the same time, if we were to be believed. I think the social element of it was as important as the political element. But I think there's a serious element to it as well, is that when you do have extreme parties, the way that the mainstream parties to recover their position is actually to throw resources at it, and is actually to try and reconnect with the electorate that they may have neglected hitherto. And so I think that if that's to be a template for what you do when you go into an area where you fear UKIP is strong, then that probably is the right one. And that approach has worked before in other places.
Yeah, and yet, Toby, you don't have busloads of activists, even if you have money to put into constituencies around the country, do you? There's just not that many young people very active in any of the big parties.
No, you don't. And this is why a by-election is so different to a general election. I mean, if you look at parties like the Lib Dems, this comes back to this point of targeting. If you look at the Lib Dems in Eastleigh, the interesting by-election that happened there, where the Lib Dems narrowly held on in the face of a UKIP surge, the way they brought activists down from all over the country. I remember talking to some lads from Sunderland and Newcastle who'd come down all the way to support the Lib Dems in Eastleigh, in sort of deepest Hampshire. That's what you can do in a by-election. That's what you can do in targeted seats, but you cannot do it, on a huge scale during an election campaign. And none of the parties have huge amounts of money. The Tories have the most. And so this is a little snapshot. It's a skirmish in a big, long war, and it has peculiar local factors. But it's not going to you can't read, Ronan's quite right, you can't read across a trend from this. You can read across what it is possible for one party to do, a party of government, if it piles in resources in the face of a series of new threats, which are UKIP, the decline of the Lib Dems as the protest party.
I accept what you say. I don't argue with any of that. But I think if you look at what happened in Barking when it had an infestation of the British National Party, they did bus a lot of people in to try and repel that. But they also signed up a lot more members, the local Lib Party. Margaret Hodge and John Cruddas did put their backs to the wheel, and they signed up a lot of people into the party who hadn't been members before.
Base, and it can use its, for instance, its union, databases and lists of addresses and stuff to motivate people. So Labour's got a good possibility in terms of mass campaigning, probably a better one than the Tories. Tories people tend to be older, less energetic, and they tend to be more concentrated.
But if you're telling them they come and canvass with you, that they might meet girls or they might meet boys and they can drink all night, which is basically what the Tories told them, wasn't it?
Yeah.
But Rowena, what about UKIP? I mean, we know about the other parties and their problems and their kind of residual strength in galvanising people, but Nigel Farage's People's Army was not on the march, slipped back a bit from where it had been in the European elections in the area. Did you sense when you were walking around Newark that there was just too many people who didn't like UKIP? Was that their problem?
You didn't really get that feeling from the places I went to with UKIP, because they picked their areas pretty well. They knew their target audience, older people, and some of the slightly less well-off areas in Newark. And they just seem to be having really a jolly old time, actually. They, you know, they'd do knock on a couple of doors and then they'd go into the pub for lunch and, you know, driving their big advertising vans around. They weren't really treating it incredibly seriously or in an organised way in the same way that the Tories are. And, it sort of reinforced that idea that they weren't really expecting to win it. I was just going to say that there's another quite interesting phenomenon that seems to be emerging in Newark that a couple of Tories and Labour MPs have been mentioning, and that's the anti-protest protest vote. So people actually tactically voting for the Tories just because they wanted to keep out UKIP.
Yes, this is exactly what I was going to ask you about. Because you look under the bonnet of that result, it seems fairly obvious there's been a great tranche of people who've moved from the Conservatives on the one hand to UKIP on the other, and that there must have been a very large number of Lib Dems who've moved over to the Conservatives, one would think.
Yes, I think that's probably a fair assumption. And I did, you know, talking to people who live there, when I wasn't out with UKIP, when I was out just talking to people in the marketplace, it was quite divisive. And some people were saying, I'm ex-conservative, I'm definitely going for UKIP. Others, they were worried about the reputational damage of having a UKIP MEP representing them in the House of Commons, even though it's only going to be 11 months or so until a general election and they could have decided to boot them out anyway.
It's interesting, isn't it, Hugh? Because they haven't had that taint as it would have done if it was the British National Party or something that lots of people, including some Conservative Liberal Democrat voters, seem to be feeling that way.
They have had to play it quite carefully. There's almost been an appeal to the dog whistle on a racist voter without being racist. And obviously, when UKIP were being accused of being racist, they went and took out a newspaper ad to say, no, we're not. And then staged that rather entertaining carnival in Croydon. But I think I've seen some research this week that said that what you need to look at is, one, the UKIP vote, but also the extent to which UKIP are energising other people, are repelling other people and maybe bringing them into the political process just to get UKIP out. I mean, it's interesting what Rowena was saying about people in Newark fearing reputational damage. And so while the plus side for UKIP is that they may be bringing people into their party and they may be getting people involved in politics who weren't involved at all before, there are also people who maybe were a bit lazy, a bit disinterested, of saying, well, if I really don't like UKIP, and I think that will be the catalyst for me to want to get involved.
Yeah, I mean, the question is, have UKIP become slightly part of the establishment now? Have they been there long enough? Are we already bored with them? Are they part of the system?
Is that why they didn't want to see? Maybe they didn't want the parliament.
Well, they certainly didn't want this. I mean, they did want it, but if they'd known they were going to win it, then Farage would have been there.
But Rowena, we did some polling a couple of months ago, well before the Euros, about, you know, never mind who you're going to vote for, but which party do you most dislike? And UKIP won fairly comfortably on the dislike index, which is the opposite from the kind of classic Lib Dem protest vote, isn't it, of 5 or 10 years ago, where the party no one disliked, and so everyone could afford to vote for in a by-election.
They are quite polarising. People seem to feel extremely strongly, and part of almost a sort of cult of UKIP when they've got on board. But the other side, I think there is a sort of growing movement among people who belong to the other parties to say, you know, we've got to stand up and fight against this. I mean, that's the argument that Nick Clegg was making when he took on Farage in the European debate.
Well, let's just move back now for a moment to David Cameron and the Conservatives and the Coalition, because we've just had the Queen's speech, Toby, which I'm sure it's fair to say the country aren't talking about this weekend.
No,
there wasn't a great deal there, was there?
No, there wasn't.
We knew about.
We knew about most of it already, and then it was massively overshadowed by this row between Michael Gove and Theresa May. And there really isn't that much on the legislative slots, which must be worrying for both coalition parties, because it opens up this void, if you like, for the coalition parties just to kind of spend the next year going for each other in the name of differentiation, because
they're not doing anything.
There isn't a lot else to do in Westminster, and in a way, what would have suited them would have to have had a bit of legislation which was quite disputatious, quite controversial, but radical and that both parties were basically behind that could have preoccupied them, but they haven't really got that. There's nothing very eye-catching in there. The pension stuff is good, but it's been heavily talked about. So I think it does open up a very, very interesting year of void politics.
An interesting void, Hugh.
You have to worry when people write about your Queen's speech and they weave in the phrases dog days and fag end.
Yeah.
It's a very long fag end.
It is, yes, a long slow burn fag. Clearly, it wasn't brimming with ideas. I think by far the most telling thing was the fact that you had, on the day that they tried to present themselves as a government with things to do, the day after Nick Clegg and David Cameron put out that joint statement saying, you know, we're still... this is still a viable coalition, you didn't have this absurd, ridiculous row between Gove and Theresa May in public.
We don't normally see, is it, like letters put on a Home Office website about what Michael Gove is alleged
to have said? Her letter was extraordinary because she was basically asking the sort of questions that you or I would ask but she's in the cabinet.
Yeah, it's not just any old issue either. This is not any old domestic political policy spat. This is terrorism, radicalisation in our schools. It could hardly be more important.
And we're still waiting for lots of reports, aren't we? You know, yeah. I mean, so the facts aren't agreed, and yet in advance of the facts, having this terrible spat.
Maybe I've got it wrong, but I thought the idea was that, you know, you kind of picked up the cabinet bat phone and Theresa said to Michael, you know what it says in the newspaper here about this school? Is this true? Instead, she actually has to write a letter and send it to him formally as if she wasn't part of the government at all.
But also Cameron's got himself into a bit of a hole about this. I'm sorry, we're supposed to be talking about the Queen's speech, but much in it. Cameron's agreed to investigate this and get to the bottom of it, as he says. And he's going to get to the bottom of it because it won't be very difficult. But then what does he do about that? What action does he take? You know, does he sack Michael Gove? Does he sack Theresa May? Does he sack Theresa May's special advisor? If he doesn't do something, he looks a bit weak in that Labour accusation.
It's an odd route. I mean, you won't have seen the like of it quite like this before, will you, Rowena? And where do you think it goes next?
Well, yeah, I'm struggling to think of anything that's burst into the open quite like this before. But then Michael Gove has been the centre of a couple of these rows in recent months. I mean, there was his attack on Boris Johnson, and then after that he had a big open row with Nick Clegg about free school meals. And so you have to wonder whether David Cameron is going to try and find a method of stopping Michael Gove going off the rails a bit. I mean, I don't know what it is. Maybe he's getting bored. Maybe he's just so frustrated with the coalition that he can't contain himself, but he does seem to be making more mischief than usual, and Cameron's going to look, as Toby says, very weak if he doesn't do something. And it's a danger of having actually announced what looks like an investigation if you don't actually come out with a conclusion.
So Jeremy Hayward will look into Michael Gove. It's a strange idea, isn't it?
I don't know. What is the disciplinary procedure within the cabinet? Because if the reports are to be believed, Cameron's already had Gove in and given them a bit of a rollicking. So what's the next stage up? Does he have
it's
a series
up to the
of
Prime
cards?
Minister, isn't it? I mean, it's supposed every student learns in their politics textbook, you know, collective responsibility. But if you're tweeting out a very, very aggressive letter on such a massively important issue, it's about as blatant a breach of collective responsibility as you can get.
Do you smell in this, Rowena, a kind of Govian ambition for the top job? Because there's been Conservative Home poll this week sort of saying that the most popular prospective leader is no longer Boris Johnson, who you said he had a previous spat with, but now Theresa May. Is there a kind of determination to take on the heir apparent?
Well, there is all of that in the background, and it is on a lot of senior Tories' minds, who will be the one to succeed Cameron if he doesn't make it all the way through the next Parliament, if he gets elected, or even if he doesn't, win the election, and then somebody else tries to succeed him. And Gove is very much considered part of the George Osborne leadership camp. He's always denied that he wants the top job himself, but there are sneaking suspicions that he's not being quite truthful about that. And you might wonder whether, well, Theresa May is another one who's jostling for that position, and that is a sort of important background to the whole row, really.
What do you think, Toby?
I suspect what's really going on here is that next week we have an Ofsted report into all these schools, the sort of allegations of radicalisation in all these schools in Birmingham. And I suspect Michael Gove knows that it's going to be very hard-hitting and critical and say that there is a real problem. And there is a blame game going on.
It seems to me that that Gove, that accepted, shows on a degree of recklessness in that, you know, you're right. This probably is his equivalent of a flak jacket. But it doesn't seem that bothered about the damage that he causes by doing it. Whereas I think that Theresa May's played her hand really quite well, because on the one hand, the right of the party see in her almost on the echoes of Thatcher and being really quite stern and tough. But she's also got quite a good reputation now with the liberal wing of the party, and even people outside the party who say, look at Theresa May, that's who she was, the one who commissioned the Stephen Lawrence report. She's now looking at Stop and Search. And I imagine part of her irritation might be saying, well, you know, we're doing all this good work to try and detoxify ourselves, and then we've got Michael Gove rampaging in and upsetting all the people we've been trying to mollify.
You really can't underestimate, I'm sure nobody does, but it just needs stressing that for an education secretary to accuse a Home Secretary of failing to take terrorism seriously enough, and then for it to flip on its side and for the other to do the same back again, I mean,
it's amazing.
Accusation
stuff.
Don't come much heavier than that.
I once a kind of polemicist columnist, I guess always a columnist. I mean, Richard Dawkins this week in another part of the forest said, you know, you can call me divisive, you can call me horrible, but don't call me boring. And I wonder if Michael Gove's in the same trap. Anyway, that's all we've got time for today. So my thanks to Hugh Muir, to Toby Helm and to Rowena Mason. The producer was Jason Phipps, and thanks very much indeed for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.